Testing, testing. Hey, I'm Ian.
And I'm Sophia.
And welcome to Talking with Green Teachers.
This is the Environmental Education Podcast, where we discuss recent developments, big ideas, and creative approaches to teaching green. In this episode,
one of the sort of most common things that we believe in, and one of the stories we're told, and one of the old fables is, you know, slow and steady wins the race, right? Not the jackrabbit, it's the turtle that wins the race. And so they're drawing on this sort of old story within our culture that is very familiar to a lot of us to say, like, hey, we just want to make sure we get it right. We just want to make sure we go slow. And what it's really about is their strategy is really just a strategy to leave the work for the next generation.
We are in the midst of a paradigm-shifting energy transition, yet many educators are struggling with how to discuss it, and more specifically, how to teach it. We sought to address these challenges with the special print edition of issue 134 of Green Teacher magazine. This episode, with journalist Max Fawcett of Canada's National Observer, is a companion to that special issue. Max joined Ian to discuss good faith and bad faith energy transition narratives, finding the balance between urgency and optimism, and engaging in meaningful discussions with those who disagree with us.
All right, so you work in the realm of narratives as a journalist, and I mean, I think a lot of people understand a narrative from the storytelling perspective of a sequence of events, but in your world as a journalist, how would you define a narrative?
To me, a narrative is a way of explaining an event or an issue that holds meaning for people. So you can explain the facts of a story, you can explain key characters in a story, but a narrative is kind of what holds it together for people. And we are a species that is sort of uniquely captivated by the power of story and by the power of narrative. And I think people recognize them, maybe not consciously when they interact with them, but we're encountering them all the time in our day-to-day lives, whether it's through, you know, advertising, through political messaging, what have you. There are so many narratives out there competing for our attention. And I think certainly that's true in, you know, in the world of journalism, the world of opinion writing as well. If you want to be good at this in some respects, you kind of have to understand and be able to tap into the power of a good narrative.
And when it comes to the energy transition, the collective knowledge has been for quite some time that the people who are skeptical, especially if it's skepticism that's been fed by a lot of counter narratives and propaganda, just showing the charts and the graphs and, you know, the hockey stick curve and all of that kind of thing, it just doesn't work. Like, we see that time and time again.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's, you would hope that we live in a world where if you provide somebody with evidence that something they believe or hold true is not the case, that they would, you know, maybe not immediately, but at some point adjust their view of the world accordingly. And, you know, as you sort of hint at it, the research that we know about in this field shows the exact opposite, that when people have a strongly held belief and they're presented with information that contradicts or conflicts with it, they actually hold on to their belief even more strongly, you know, whether that's as a, you know, safety blanket or a form of kind of intellectual self-defense. But facts just don't have the curative power that we, I think, wish that they did. And so, you know, the thing that becomes important is narrative. What is the story that you're telling yourself about the world, about this particular aspect of the world, this issue, and your place within it? And I think that, you know, in a lot of respects, the people on the other side of the climate change issue have understood this for a very long time. Much longer than I think we have. People who believe in climate change, people who think we need to do something about it, have kind of thought that if we can just show people the science and tap into or sort of activate their better natures, that everything would kind of flow from there. And that's being put up against, you know, well-funded, certainly oil and gas industry and other adjacent industries that benefit from the status quo, who are telling a much richer story. And they know how to activate different people within our various, you know, lives and professional universes that validate their narrative, that or that act, you know, that amplify their narrative in it. And there's a sophistication there that I think people who are pro-climate change, pro-climate policy, haven't entirely caught up to. It's funny, you know, I hear often from people in the oil and gas industry that the green left is this sort of, you know, powerful force, and we have control so many things, and we're, you know, we control the banking system, and we control this, that, and the other, and the media. And it's like, no, we're actually just a very disorganized group of well-meaning people.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, it's quite the opposite. It's much more deliberate. It's much more professional. And they are weaponizing the power of narrative to their advantage. And one of the things that I've sort of been trying to communicate in my work, both in my writing and in my political advocacy, is that we need to be better at narrative on our side. We need to develop and share a narrative that isn't just things are bad or there is a threat and we need to do something about it, but that there is an exciting future out there for us if we do the right things, right? A kind of empowering narrative rather than a disempowering one. And, you know, I've gotten pushback from folks in the climate community that, you know, you're being Pollyannish. It's too, can't be optimistic about something that is sort of so inherently unsettling. But
mm-hmm.
if we want people to go along with us for the ride outside of the, you know, the whatever percent of us that are already at the table, we have to meet them where they are. And where they are is not where we are, right? And that's kind of what narrative does. It can bring people along on that journey. And there are parts of it that people will identify with. And then, you know, as time goes on, maybe they start to identify with more and more of it. But, you know, facts alone and being very sort of earnest and sober-minded about it is just not good enough to get people to come with us for the journey they need to.
And it is so unfortunate that that's just how we are wired and programmed. And, well, it's just what it is. I mean, it's fortunate, it's unfortunate, depending on your perspective. But it is what it is. It's the reality of social psychology, of human psychology. And do you think there's like a hesitancy of people who support climate action to craft narratives just because, like, when I think of how many narratives have been put out by defenders of the status quo, including various members of the fossil fuel industry, just the word narrative itself is tainted for me because I'm like, there's so many counter narratives that are coming from a bad faith place. It almost feels wrong in a way to counter that with narratives, like the fight fire with fire sort of thing. However, as you say, I mean, social psychology, human psychology, that's just how we're wired. I mean, do we just kind of have to get over that?
I think so. I mean, I have been accused many, many times of being a centrist, a liberal, someone who cares more about winning than he should. And my response to that has always been, do you want to be right or do you want to win? The two are not always the same thing. And we have to understand who we're dealing with here. And it's not rational, fact processing, good faith, emotionally neutral creatures. You know, unfortunately, human beings are a little more complicated than that. And if the other side is pressing on the parts of our lizard brain to get us to react, I'm not saying that we have to do the exact same thing, but we have to respect the fact that there is a lizard brain in there that does not react rationally to a lot of things. And so to me, the answer has always been try to be optimistic about it. People are much more likely to gravitate towards a story of the future in which they're thriving than one in which they are not. That's a lot of what the fossil fuel industry taps into with their narratives, is basically telling people that things can be the same, right? That they don't have to change. The world is not getting worse. They are not responsible for it. And they can just continue living their lives the way they've lived them over the last however many years. That's a very attractive concept to a lot of people. Now, obviously, you know, in the climate movement or the, you know, people who care about climate change, we can't say that because our fundamental belief is that things are getting worse. They are changing in ways that are not hospitable to human thriving. But we can tell a story, I think, of collective action, of kind of solidarity, you know, drawing on some of the lessons in our past, you know, from, you know, whether it's the Second World War or whatever, where people were experiencing hardship, but they pulled together, they pulled through. And what happened after was, you know, a better and more prosperous way of living. And I think we can kind of tell that story to ourselves in a way that allows us to be optimistic, to not give in or give up, you know, and to sort of maintain our resolve as we go forward. And, you know, it's interesting in Alberta, you know, obviously a big oil and gas industry here, to me, it's sort of a fascinating laboratory of which arguments work well in difficult places. I mean, I think it's easier to make a case for climate action in a place like California or, you know, Western Europe or somewhere where the economy is not so inextricably linked to extracting fossil fuels. In Alberta, it's much tougher because you are immediately presented with this choice. You know, do we choose the economy or do we choose the climate?
Yeah, this binary.
This binary, and it's a false choice, but it's one that, you know, that the oil and gas industry has weaponized very effectively. And so there was a project here back in 2017, 2018 called the Alberta Narratives Project. And it was a group of researchers who basically went around talking in different communities to different people, testing like which arguments actually work to get people to support climate action and which arguments work to get people in the tougher spaces, you know, people who work in the oil and gas industry, people who are in communities that are heavy in oil and gas. And it's interesting. It is definitely one where the talk is more around growth than transition. You know, you don't talk about replacing, you talk about adding.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people get anxious about that, but my response to that is always, if it gets people to come along for the ride, they will figure out eventually that it's about replacing. But in the near term, it's about adding, get them excited about the adding. You know, you don't need people exactly where you are to have them on the same side as you. One of the other interesting lessons was people want you to be honest. You know, so I think the government, the NDP government, the progressive government that was here for a brief and wonderful 4 years and did some very amazing things. You know, the climate leadership plan put in a price on carbon here. It was a big deal, but they called it a carbon levy, not a carbon tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the Narratives Project suggested that that was not the right thing to do. People felt like they were being messaged. They felt like they were being lied to. And so there is actually a case in this narrative building for kind of dealing your cards off the top of the deck with people. You know, you tell them what they're up against. It's not going to be easy, but we'll do it together and we'll come out the other side stronger than before. And I think that is sort of the core of a narrative that progressives can work with. You know, they shouldn't try to scare people, but they also shouldn't be soft pedaling what the solutions will mean.
Yeah, like Chris Turner wrote about this in his book, How to Be a Climate Optimist, that we need to get away from this idea of a deficit model where we're trying to make things less bad in the future and more like, you know, how is this, yes, better for the atmosphere, better ecologically, sure, but also like more comfortable. I mean, he talked about, I think it was riding on a bullet train or some other vehicle like that. And not only was he glad to be riding on that because it's not emitting fossil fuels, but it was also just like a slick ride. And he was like drinking a sherry while he was going. And it was like, this is like kind of awesome. And yeah, maybe we don't tell enough of those stories of, you know, this is what it could be like. I mean, aren't cities going to be quieter if we are all driving electric vehicles? I mean, to me, that's really appealing for a lot of people.
Exactly. I think that's a really key part of it is if we're selling people on, you know, you make all these sacrifices and then the thing that is out there that is sort of terrible and threatening will be less terrible and threatening. It's kind of hard to get excited about, right?
Yeah.
But if you're selling them on, hey, we're going to have these great technologies and you're going to be able to zip around town in an electric car. It's going to be so cool. And you're going to live in these communities where you can walk to things and see your kids more, your friends more often. They can see their grandparents more often. Like, sign me up. It sounds fantastic, right? We need to do a better job in the climate movement of identifying the things that people are actually willing to get motivated about. You know, those of us who get motivated about the big picture, about emissions, about climate change, I think we're all at the table now. There's no more of us that can be activated. But people who care about being stuck in traffic less often, people who care about shorter commutes, people who care about cool cars and bullet trains, like there's a lot of those people out there who are ready and able to join the movement who just haven't been spoken to in the right way. If you can tell them a story of the future that isn't just, hey, you know, it'll be your life, but you'll do fewer things and this big thing will be less terrible. Instead, you say, it'll be your life, but way better, you know, your life on steroids, they'll be ready to join. And I think it requires a kind of optimistic mindset that maybe doesn't come naturally to people who care deeply about climate change, because I think we're all on some level kind of sitting there with this gnawing feeling in the pit of our stomach about what might happen if we don't do this right. And that comes through to people. It's easier to bring people to your side if you're Piglet than if you're Eeyore.
Yes.
And I think it's sort of an important thing to remember and when we're talking to other people. And it's funny, I was struck, there was a speech that the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, mm-hmm. Jacinda Ardern, gave at a recent conference where she was talking about her work in trying to convince people to support her government's policies. And you know, she's saying, like, look, if someone gets excited about buying an electric vehicle because it goes really fast, that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
I don't need them to believe everything I believe. I don't need them to want to buy an EV for the reasons I want to buy an EV. As long as they buy the EV, mission accomplished, right? And so being, I think, a little bit more ruthless about the ends getting us through the means would serve us well.
Yeah, I mean, the moral purity sort of thing, just we don't have time for that, frankly. I think it's just, you know, it's a nice thought, but we can't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And
yeah.
If you get him there, how you get him there maybe isn't so important.
Hey, it's Ian. I'm just here to let you know about two of our newest books, Teaching Kids About Climate Change and Teaching Teens About Climate Change. Each one is kind of like an educator's toolbox with ready-to-use hands-on lessons focused on four core dimensions of climate change. Visit greenteacher.com to get your copies. We also have special rates available for bulk orders, and all proceeds go back into the nonprofit.
Kind of backtracking a bit, we talked a bit at the beginning about the various narratives that vested interests like fossil fuel companies or, you know, libertarian think tanks have. And I don't want to cast them all with the same brush because, of course, there's nuance with everything. But it's been very well documented in books like Merchants of Doubt and more recent books even about just the unbelievable funding that's gone into it and the unbelievable efforts to just defend the status quo like mad. And I mean, what can we learn from some of those narratives that are out there? And they've certainly evolved. I mean, the outright deniers, although there's maybe been a bit of a resurgence since Twitter/X changed hands, but we don't have to get into that whole thing. But for the most part, I think most people aren't outright deniers, but it's become almost more nuanced and insidious in a way. Defenders of the status quo, like, what are the big narratives that you're seeing out there from these defenders?
Yeah, it was so much easier when they denied the science because you could just point to the science and be like, well, you know, I guess we're done here. The one that I see a lot in Canada and in Alberta, and I think we see it in a lot of places, and this is a very Canadian metaphor, so forgive me, I'll explain it. But we see that what is called ragging the puck.
Yeah.
So that in hockey is when you kind of, you're not actually trying to score a goal, you're just trying to burn time off the clock. And so you're just skating around your own end of the rink, just killing time because you know you're winning. And we see a lot of that on the part of the people who used to be sort of professional deniers, that they're now professional puck raggers. And so what they're saying is, hey, no argument on climate change. We know we got to reduce emissions. We know where we got to go, but we need more time, right? We don't want to go too fast. And, you know, we need time to develop the technology. And hey, we agree on goals. We just disagree on this slight little thing around timing. And it's a very seductive argument.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it sounds like they're agreeing. They're not. Number two, it sounds like they're being reasonable. I mean, one of the sort of most common things that we believe in, and one of the stories we're told, and one of the old fables is, you know, slow and steady wins the race, right? Not the jackrabbit, it's the turtle that wins the race. And so they're drawing on this sort of old story within our culture that is very familiar to a lot of us to say, like, hey, we just want to make sure we get it right. We just want to make sure we go slow. And what it's really about is, you know, especially in the oil and gas industry, most of the decision makers, virtually all the decision makers, are in their late 40s to early 60s. So these are people who really just need to get through the next decade. And then they get to go home with their stock options. They get to go home with their, you know, with their benefits fully vested, and they can leave the problem for someone else. Their strategy is really just a strategy to leave the work for the next generation. And to me, that's where we kind of have to call it out. We say, you know, thank you for agreeing on basic principles. You know, we want to get the ship going in the same direction, but we think that leaving it till the very end is actually the riskiest thing of all. And it's unfair. It's unfair to future generations. It's unfair to my kids. It's unfair to your kids to make them do all the heavy lifting when we're the ones who have done a lot of the problem creating in the first place. So it's a tougher argument to make. It's a tougher lift because the former denier position sounds much more reasonable, but at its core, it's still about doing nothing, right? It's still about creating license for them to continue business as usual. It's just a much more sophisticated license.
Yeah. And it's so hard with, you know, also this counter narrative of, well, oil and gas has made us incredibly wealthy and it's immoral to deprive impoverished people in other countries in the global south from this wonderful wealth that we have absolutely enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no question. I mean, I've benefited from it immensely and will continue to benefit from it immensely. So it is also a seductive argument when I hear this, well, you know, we can't be saying no to gas powered plants in sub-Saharan Africa. Like, that's a tough one to navigate around, I find.
It is. The argument I use there, you know, I compare it to the development of connectivity in the developing world. And, you know, I'm of an age, you're of an age, a lot of people are of an age where they remember having a landline, maybe even having a party line. You know, we had the phones that were, you know, wired into the house, and it was great. We couldn't imagine anything else. And then cell phones came along and all of a sudden landlines started to disappear. And now I don't even think you could get a new landline in North America, even if you wanted to. I think they're ripping them all out everywhere. And so it's not like people in the developing world have to move through the stations of the cross the way we did. You know, we had landlines, they have to have landlines, and then they get to have mobile. No, they just go straight to the best technology, right? One of the advantages, if you can call it that, of being in a developing country is, you know, you don't have to go through the lessons that we went through. You simply get the best technology that's available in the moment. And especially in large parts of, you know, Africa, Southeast Asia, it's solar. Solar is the best technology. You know, storage technology needs to catch up a little bit there. But yeah, the idea that, you know, well, we can't deprive them of using fossil fuels. What we should try to avoid depriving them of is the best possible quality of life. And we should be agnostic about which technology delivers that. If they think solar is better for them, then build solar. They don't have to build gas just because we built gas. And we should be honest about what those arguments are really about. You know, when people in the West say, well, they have to have access to fossil fuels because we did, it's because we want to sell fossil fuels to them. It's because we want to continue selling fossil fuels. And so it's not benevolence. It's not charity. It's actually selfishness that's motivating that argument. I think people in India and China and the developing world, in Indonesia and, you know, South Africa, they understand that they don't have to do things just because the West did them. I think people will be very, very surprised. They would be surprised if they actually paid attention. It's already happening. But the degree to which renewable energy is just blowing things away in large parts of that part of the world. Because guess what? If you're a developing country, you don't want to be paying to import fossil fuels from somewhere else. That's not good for your economy. It's not good for your balance of payments. You want to grow your own energy. And the good news is these countries can all do it.
And really the best kind of international charity, and this is advice that I've heard, you know, when you talk to people who go to developing countries to work on a project, is don't just drop in and be a burden. Help people help themselves.
Yeah.
You know, if you can be there to maybe move the process forward a couple steps, great. But the whole point is for you not to be needed.
Exactly. The people who are saying, oh, you know, won't somebody please think of the developing countries and their quality of life? If they really want to be of assistance there, we should be lending them low-cost capital, expertise, giving them sort of development loans so that they can build the capacity in their own countries to power themselves. And that's what they're saying. You know, they've repeatedly come to the table at climate conferences and said, the developed world needs to make more money, more capital available to us so that we can do this ourselves. So let's do it. You know, there's no case for us telling them what they should or shouldn't be using in terms of energy, but we can help them build what they feel is best for them.
For sure. Well, before we wrap up, because our listenership is mostly environmental and outdoor educators who certainly understand the importance of narrative and they understand the importance of teaching about the energy transition. However, they might be teaching students who themselves or whose parents may be more resistant and they might find themselves in these discussions, you know, at a parent-teacher meeting that can get heated or contentious. So I know you've been in the belly of the beast, and I mean, you, with your podcast Maxed Out, you deliberately go into the belly of the beast to talk to people that you might disagree with, which is very admirable, by the way.
Thank you.
What is your advice when you're, you know, having those discussions and you just see that you're coming at it from a very different perspective as the other person?
So I was, there's a big thing in Alberta every year called the Calgary Stampede. I'm sure some of your listeners have heard about it, but it's a big sort of Western culture extravaganza festival. And then there's also lots of business that happens alongside of that. And I was at an event, a couple of oil and gas CEOs and myself, audience was filled with oil and gas executives talking about climate policy and the oil and gas industry. And I got some very, very, very good shots in on these CEOs that they did not see coming. But the way I was able to do it, you know, it was just the truth. But the way I did it was kill them with kindness. You know, you have to acknowledge that they are not coming from a bad place, you know, whether they work in the industry or whether they hold these beliefs or whether they're skeptical about climate policy. It's not because they're bad people. It's not because they want to do harm to the world. It's because they have a different lived experience and they have different values. And so I think starting in these conversations by honoring that they're coming from a good place, right? Where you're coming from is not, you know, I'm not standing in judgment of you. I'm not, you know, I'm not moralizing. I'm not saying that you're a bad person. We just disagree on the best way to build a good future for our kids, and really kind of make that the frame. Is it's not about you, right? It's about what's best for your kids, what's best for the future and the world that they get to live in. And I think starting from that premise opens people up a little bit. You're not going to move these people off their position visibly, certainly, you know, not in one or two encounters. So really your job is just to kind of give them something to think about, right? To show them that you're coming from a good place, to show that you see that they're coming from a good place, and that, you know, your concerns are ultimately fair and valid. And, you know, people, if and when they change their minds, it's slow and over time. But I think we, especially in the sort of online world that we live in right now, we have a tendency to kind of want to rain hellfire and brimstone down on people when they disagree with us. But the truth of the matter is, you know, except for the odd sort of, I don't know, sociopath, most of us have very similar desires for our lives, for the lives of our kids. It's just how we pursue them that is different. And so I think if you can kind of ground the conversation in that sort of mutual shared interest, then things can go a little better. And, you know, at the end, if you have to agree to disagree, there's good in that too, right? It's healthy to be able to disagree with people and walk away with a smile on your face.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. I always love, you know, with the hockey playoffs, I just love watching the handshake line for some reason. I'll watch it on repeat. Gone through this grind of this very physical series, but then there's, you know, handshakes and I don't know. I'm a big sucker for that. So that's my confirmation bias that I certainly have to be aware of. But yeah, like I agree with you. And maybe this is a bit naive, but I don't think there are that many really bad actors out there. I mean, we know they're out there. We hear about them on the news. But like, I think most people are pretty reasonable. And, you know, we can all agree on we want to have a good future. We want to be safe. We want our kids to be healthy and secure. I mean, I don't know anyone, certainly not in my circle, that would disagree with any of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we are often animated, especially in the media environment we're in right now, by bad angels, bad actors, people who want us to disagree, who want us to be at each other's throats because, you know, it serves the algorithm or it serves the financial incentives of their organization. But, at the end of the day, we have more in common with each other than I think we sometimes appreciate. And you know, the way to have a breakthrough on these issues, in my experience, is slow. Slow and steady. And, you know, okay, there I'm tapping in again to that narrative frame that they're using to, you know, to slow roll progress. But it's not going to be a sort of decisive breakthrough. You know, I've always found with climate policy that if you're way deep in the weeds, it's easy to get really kind of bummed out about how little progress we're making.
Yeah.
And then you look around compared to where, you know, the way things were 5 or 10 years ago, and you go, actually, we've made a ton of progress. Like, you know, we've made progress on common objectives. We've made progress on technology. We've made progress on legislation. It's not fast enough. It doesn't feel like we're moving with nearly the urgency that we should. But society is a Titanic strapped on top of a Titanic. You know, it moves slowly. And sometimes the changes are kind of imperceptible until you're down the water a ways and you realize, oh, we've moved 10 kilometers off course or on a different course. So, you know, above all, I guess, try to stay optimistic, as hard as it is, because if nothing else, it makes your arguments more attractive. It helps you stay in the game better.
It's a great way to end off on. And there's so much, of course, we could continue to unpack. And I wish those of us pushing for climate action had as much funding as those not pushing for it, but that's a whole other, that could be a whole other podcast.
Exactly. Don't even get me started about that one.
Yeah, well, for sure. Well, thanks so much for your time, Max. I know you're incredibly busy keeping tabs on all of the very complex things that are happening in the world, and keep up the good work with your show, Maxed Out, and your ongoing columns with Canada's National Observer.
Well, thank you, Ian, and thank you to your audience. I'm an atheist, but they're doing the Lord's work right now in trying to get this message out there to kids and dealing with whatever blowback they might have to deal with. And yeah, it's a worthy thing to be doing, and I'm glad they're doing it.
You're here.
The energy transition is well underway, and momentum is building with each passing year. Knowing how to effectively communicate the opportunities inherent in this transition can play a big part in getting us to that clean energy paradigm of the now not so distant future. Talking with Green Teachers is co-hosted by Ian Shanahan and me, Sofia Vargas Nesi. Ian is the show's writer and editor. Logo design is by Devin Terrien. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes to get instant access to each new episode. If you really like the show, give us a rating too. We can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We'll chat again soon. We thank the Ivy Foundation for supporting this episode and the companion special print magazine issue about the energy transition.